This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll take a look at the new laws legalizing marijuana in Washington State and Colorado. We'll examine how they fit into the context of federal legislation.
We've waited 40 years for the dawning of the Age of Aquarius. It's finally here.
We'll talk with Glenn Ford about the events unfolding in Syria and Egypt.
Is there really one good side and one bad side in Egypt and in Syria? Or are we getting incomplete news from our media?
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Heidi, at Christmas time, I often walk or stroll down the street looking in all the beautiful Christmas windows, displays, etc. And there's a lot of mannequins in those windows. They're dressed in various interesting clothes, Christmas outfits, etc. And I normally just keep going, look at them, and move on. But something strange has been going on lately, apparently. I'm not the only one looking at them. Something else is happening. What's happening?
That's right, Michael. You're actually being monitored by those mannequins. A new product called the EYESEE, is a mannequin, a slender polystyrene frame, blank face, and in her eye is embedded a camera with facial recognition data so that the software can gather information about you, logging in age, gender, and even the race of those who pass by that mannequin.
Well, what would be the point of that? They could just stick a camera on the store, I presume, and look at everybody going by. But something else is going on. They want me to look straight at the mannequin. They think I'm going to look more at the mannequin. They're trying to get my shopping habits?
They're trying to get your shopping habits. This is similar technology to what we already see in things like RFID chips implanted in products that you buy that when you use your charge card, for example, captures that personal data about you. And as we know, large data aggregators, big business in the U.S., captures that information, resells it to retailers so that they can target market you. You heard about the story of the teenager who went to the Target store. I guess a few weeks later, her father received in the mail some promotional materials aimed at mothers-to-be. It was pregnancy clothes. The father, irate, went to the Minneapolis Target store and said, "Why are you sending this stuff?" It turned out the daughter was indeed pregnant. The family didn't know, obviously. But the store had been collecting information on her and using a data analyst figured out who was pregnant or who they thought was pregnant, and then they send materials to them.
So it helps the store get our shopping habits, et cetera. Presumably, if I look at a mannequin doing X versus wearing Y or something, they'll record that. But is there also any kind of law enforcement purpose to any of this, or will any of this be shared with...
Well, obviously, the use of these cameras, as with many other surveillance technology, does raise some legal and certainly many ethical issues. The United States and European regulations do permit using cameras for security purposes, and as you know, retailers have to put up signs letting customers know that they may be filmed. Watching people just for commercial gain may break the rules, and some could view it as gathering personal information without consent, especially in this case where they get a little more information than just a snapshot of who you are. It gathers, you know, more information about your profile.
By that, you mean what I'm wearing, things like that?
Well, your race. And then I guess the idea is that if it could keep this information, and now they have biometric information that could, facial recognition software, they could conceivably link it to your identity.
So we link those cameras, of course, or they could easily be linked to the cameras we have all over our cities, and then they make these composites, et cetera.
And they're available to law enforcement.
Right, so that's really crucial.
That's now, crucial. And we know that law enforcement in New York City, especially with its big anti-terrorism department, has been gathering data and storing it in a huge data bank.
Heidi, this looks like it could be another element of a TV program, which I haven't seen, but people have told me about, called Person of Interest, where they take cameras all over the city
and they consolidate them to try and do something, and then they get the people before they, quote, commit a crime or something? I don't know.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, Michael, because this eyeball camera isn't the only new development. A couple of years ago, the Department of Homeland Security has come up with a camera that can give you a 360-degree view so that it doesn't just capture a still shot of you. It can literally pinpoint you, Michael Ratner, down the street and follow you. The camera moves, it tracks and pans just like a film director would. Can zoom in on objects, people, vehicles, so it could conceivably follow a car with a license plate down the block. I think that what you're saying, what we see in fiction, science fiction especially, is coming true. It's here, surveillance state.
I think that's right. I mean, not to particularly push it, although to push it in a way, because I started Julian Assange's new book, Cypherpunks, and it basically, it's a great book because it puts forth a thesis that we have this massive surveillance state, that it's everywhere, and that we actually can't stop it. And the problems with it is not just that it surveils us, but it's a way to impose a tyranny by the powers that be because they know everything about what we're doing, and that it's very hard to deal with right now. And he, of course, suggests using cryptography and other methods of communicating. He says that the way to get around it, you're going to have to use cryptography or something, and that the fact that they know so much now could lead to really tyranny in a way because they know everything about us and at some point can crack down when they want. So it's a serious, serious issue. I mean, I recommend the book Cypherpunks. It's very good on this issue.
I think a final point on that, Michael, is that when people are aware they're being watched, as we are now in all public spaces and even from the privacy of your own home, with every keystroke that you literally make on your computer or cell phone, it destroys a sense of in-person community. And while online organizing and the immediacy of electronic communication has brought us to new levels, the lack of in-person community and the fears that people face when they gather either to protest or even to get a neighbor to come together for a meeting to talk about, you know, local hydrofracking or something. We become self-conscious when we know that we're being watched. We change our behavior, and I think that it is a way of social control in terms of corporations partnering with the government to really send a chilling message that we have information on you. We know where you are. We know when you're meeting. But with location technology, Michael, GPS embedded in our phones, you know that's how, through triangulation, they got the Milan kidnappers.
Well, you know what Assange says in this book, Cypherpunks? He's about cell phones. We've talked about it before, but it's such a good quote. A cell phone is basically a tracking device that makes phone calls. So there you have it. But next time you walk down the street, keep your eyes averted from the mannequins in the windows. Look straight ahead. Try not to turn your head to the right or the left.
Michael, I noticed that the New York Times wasn't present during Bradley Manning's testimony. You were there. What's happened since he testified and since his lawyer, David Coombs, spoke publicly on the issue?
Well, the Bradley Manning case is going on at Fort Meade. It's the pretrial phase. There was a 10-day hearing on his treatment while he has been in custody. He's been in custody 2.5 years, but particularly focusing on his imprisonment in cages in Kuwait and in horrible solitary in Quantico. And the hearing was to determine whether that was a form of pretrial punishment and whether Bradley Manning ought to get not just credit for the days he spent in that, but 10 days for every day he spent in that off his ultimate sentence, or even get all the charges dismissed. What was outrageous here, and we've mentioned before, is the failure of major media, but particularly the New York Times, to cover the testimony of Bradley Manning, particularly a week ago when I was actually there and heard some of the most moving and compelling testimony of torture and abuse that I've ever heard in a courtroom. The Times finally got embarrassed enough and they sent a reporter, Charlie Savage, there for 3 hours to cover the hearing, but it was after Manning had testified. He then wrote an article in the Times that was, you know, to be honest, is very vague and not always exactly correct and precise, but they finally did cover it. Of course, that was after the public editor of the New York Times wrote an online blog saying how outrageous it is that the Times has failed to cover the Bradley Manning case, and hearing the excuse, well, we took the AP story and all of this. And of course, this is the most important single court-martial probably since the Vietnam War that's gone on. In addition, the Times relies heavily on WikiLeaks documents, which Bradley Manning was allegedly the source of. In fact, on account of the number of editions of the paper that used WikiLeaks documents, in the first 4 months of the year, really about 150 editions, so the first 5 months of the year 2012, almost half relied on WikiLeaks documents for their stories in one way or another. So here the Times has a major alleged source on trial for life sentence possibly, and they're not even sending a reporter from their Washington bureau, which is an hour away.
Stark contrast from the Pentagon paper days.
Contrast the coverage of the Times of Bradley Manning to O.J. Simpson. O.J. Simpson, there were apparently 1,600 stories in the 4 months before the trial. There were sometimes as many as four stories a day on the O.J. Simpson case. Contrast that with Bradley Manning. We've now had a reporter write two stories on the Bradley Manning case, and only after the public editor went after the New York Times for the coverage. I want to bring people up to date on Bradley Manning. That hearing is now over in terms of the hearing on how he was treated pre-trial. I've discussed on this show, as well as on a number of other shows, his treatment and abuse during that. I won't go through that here, just to say that the judge will decide within the next few weeks whether that was a form of pretrial punishment, what it amounted to, and what credit he might get on any eventual sentence. Manning's trial, because of the length of this hearing, has now been put off until March. I assume that I will be a part of that trial. Others will as well. If you want to cover that trial, there are good people covering it, particularly Fire Dog Lake covers it, the Bradley Manning Support Network, a man named Nathan Fuller covers it. So there's people out there who are going faithfully, Alexa O'Brien, who go every day to that trial, and that's the only way you can really cover it. Of course, because there's secrecy at the trial in the sense not of classified, but there's no transcripts available, there's no court documents you can look at, no judge's order. So we have a lawsuit around that as well. So it's essentially a very secret trial, and there's really should be a really heavier demand for the Times.
So Bradley Manning is still incarcerated near Fort Meade.
Well, after there were huge public objections to his treatment at Quantico, including the State Department spokesperson Crawley, who said the conditions weren't good, were bad, and he was forced to resign, they moved Bradley Manning from Quantico to Leavenworth. He was in medium security at Leavenworth, which is the lowest level they put pretrial detainees in. So he was like fine. He was confined. So all this punishment that he had and abuse is obviously was not necessary for any, quote, protection of suicide, et cetera, against suicide. With that part was BS. Unfortunately, the treatment was real, genuine, and abusive. So now he has been kept at Fort Meade, I think, pending these various motions. I don't know whether they take him back to Leavenworth in between. I don't think they do. He just stays. He stays at Fort Meade because there's hearings now every month and even more. So that's where Bradley Manning's case is. We expect the trial in March. Maybe it'll be delayed again. There's also, of course, the listeners know that the Center and myself represent Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. And on that front, the really only significant fact to report is that as of December 20th of this year, Julian Assange will have spent 6 months in the Ecuadorian embassy, where he's been given political asylum, but where he is not allowed to leave, or he will be arrested by the British and sent to Sweden, and we believe forwarded to the United States eventually.
And Michael, is there any limit, do you think, to the length of time he can spend at the Ecuadorian embassy?
There's no limit other than his own psychological state.
Right.
And what happens in Ecuador. So he has been given political asylum by Ecuador, but if you got a right-wing president controlled by the United States or in behest to the United States, that president could withdraw political asylum. Couldn't stay in the embassy, and he'd have to leave and get arrested. Now, Correa, who is the president of Ecuador, is running again in the election in the fall. It's expected that he will win and have another 4 years, and hopefully during the next period that Julian Assange and the countries around him and others can get enough pressure to get him out of that embassy safely and get him to Ecuador. Ultimately, we want to get rid of the U.S. investigation and or charges because that's what will make him a fugitive the rest of his life. I want to close on just saying what's happening now is really incredible repression by the United States of people who attempt to break the broad surveillance net that is happening on the internet, to break the secrecy that the government uses the internet for, and they are coming down very, very heavily on those people. So you have Julian Assange in the embassy. You have Bradley Manning being tortured and abused, sitting in a prison. You have Jeremy Hammond at Metropolitan Correctional Center, who was allegedly the hacker that got the Stratfor documents, the private intelligence company, and loaded those to WikiLeaks. You have a man named Aaron Swartz, who is 25 years old. He actually helped invent the RSS feed. He is charged with putting a computer somewhere at MIT and downloading what are called the JSTOR documents, which are all the academic journals, 4.8 million of them. None of them were ever released, but he is yet facing 35 years in prison. So we're talking now about serious, serious hit at people. And then there's a recent case, which I'll just mention, Barrett Brown. Barrett Brown was arrested on threatening the FBI, which was a BS case, I think. But he just got indicted on another charge, which was, as I recall, it's taking a link to the Stratfor documents from a chat room and transferring the link to his chat room. Isn't alleged to do any of the cracking of the documents or the hacking. For all I know, that link was out there way before then. And what it seems to be is they probably don't have a very strong case against Barrett Brown on this threatening the FBI agents, and they're going after him on something that all of us do all the time, which is move links from one place to another. At least it seems that we do that all the time, if that's the charge.
I think that's true. I think the difference is that Barrett Brown has been an outspoken advocate on behalf of Anonymous for the last year and a half or 2 years. And I know, as you know, that when someone speaks effectively, consistently, and in an outspoken fashion, they're often targeted by the government.
No, I think that's critical, what you're saying. I think that's why they went after him originally on the FBI thing, and now they're going after him on this. Because how many people out there actually move one link to another?
Exactly. To contextualize everything you've just said, we have to look back at Obama's promise that he was going to increase protections for whistleblowers, and yet, of all the presidents, as we know, he's been the harshest. There are all these indictments, and some of them very strong charges, espionage, etc. So
he has been the harshest. He did sign a bill giving more protections to whistleblowers. It just doesn't include anything to do with national security. So what does it include? It includes what? Doesn't include right. anything that I, even who steps yeah. on the flower garden at the White House. So.
Right. Washington State and Colorado are the first jurisdictions in the country to legalize the use of marijuana, much as alcohol is regulated. But federal laws explicitly criminalize marijuana transactions, and the federal government can continue to enforce those laws by blocking the progress of these state initiatives. For example, it's likely that the federal authorities will step in when large transactions and large-scale production begin in Washington or Colorado. Meanwhile, the Colorado provision specifically allows personal possession of up to 1 ounce of marijuana and the growing of up to 6 plants in one's home. To get a better grasp of the new marijuana laws, medical marijuana, and more, we're joined today by Ethan Nadelman, founder and executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, the leading organization in the United States promoting alternatives to the so-called war on drugs.
Ethan Nadelman, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. It's good to be here.
Before you get to the first question, I want to just say, you've been a life of struggle around legalization of drugs. Is that right?
Well, I would say about ending the drug war, right? I mean, it really has been about legalizing marijuana, you know, reducing incarceration, treating addiction as a health issue, but it's definitely a struggle worth living for.
Ethan, it seems with the change in the law in Colorado and the state of Washington, that the genie's out of the bottle. What's the state of the law now? Where are we at?
Well, I mean, you said it, Michael, because what Washington and Colorado did on Election Day this year by voting to legally regulate marijuana like alcohol, they were not just the first two states in the United States to do this. They're the first two political jurisdictions anywhere in the world to vote to do this. Almost paradoxically, while the U.S. continues to be the leading champion of the global war on drugs at home and abroad, at the level of civil society, public opinion, and state government, America, the United States of America, is emerging as the global leader of marijuana law reform. Now, what's happened in Colorado and Washington is over the last few days, both of those initiatives entered into force, which means as of now, it is legal under state law to possess up to an ounce of marijuana, and in the state of Colorado, legal to grow up to 6 plants in the privacy of your own home. The parts of the initiative that authorized the state to set up a legal regulatory system, like with alcohol, that doesn't kick in Colorado until July, and in Washington State till next December. So nobody's got to do anything real fast. The feds don't have to make any pronouncements or shut this down or give it a green light right away. I mean, it would help, but at this point, the process is moving forward, and the states have to, state governments have to figure out how they're going to regulate this stuff.
That means if I go to the state of Washington tomorrow, I can go buy marijuana from somebody? Is that what it means?
Well, no, you cannot legally buy it or sell it or grow it like in Washington state as yet, right? What you can do is possess up to an ounce.
In
right?
Washington.
And not in public either. Let's be clear. Uh-huh. You know, I mean, you know, people saw the news articles last week where it said that that there were people smoking out in public. And the Seattle Police Department was very clear that they were kind of not enforcing the law that day if people wanted to celebrate publicly. It was like people after the repeal of alcohol prohibition all drinking in public when, in fact, it still may not have been legal to drink and get drunk in
so
public.
So you can smoke at home, in other words.
You can smoke at home. You can possess up to an ounce in your pocket, your coat, whatever, your suitcase, and that's not going to be an arrest.
It'd be a big deal in New York because a lot of the reasons in stop and frisk that they get people is because they have an ounce or less in their pocket.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's subterfuge that the NYPD has been doing for the last 10 or 15 years about getting mostly young black and brown kids to take what's out of their pockets, and thereby when they reveal a joint, what was an infraction for which you cannot get arrested, now the marijuana is in public view and it's a misdemeanor to get arrested. We've made a lot of progress on that issue too. I mean, let's face it, almost nobody beats Ray Kelly. But, you know, my colleagues at Drug Policy Alliance led a broad coalition effort and pushed back the mayor and the police chief, rallied the DAs to say this policy made no sense, got Governor Cuomo to introduce a proposal. So, I mean, this is really about Washington, Colorado was breaking new ground on legalizing. New York City was about saying to the cops, this is ridiculous. Stop it.
Well, this is really promising, hopeful. What would you say if you got a call from somebody in the Obama administration and they said, Ethan, give us some reasons for not doing something about this?
Well, the first thing I would say is when you look in Colorado, the marijuana legalization initiative got more votes than President Obama did. And when you look in Washington State, the initiative got just a few fewer than Obama did and more than either the Democrat guy who won for governor, Martin Inslee, or the guy who won for the attorney general's race. So these things won not by like, you know, an inch. They won 55-45, more or less, in both states.
In my political science courses, they call that a landslide.
Yeah, it was a landslide, and even people on my side were surprised by this. The second thing I'd point out is that 2 years ago, you know, when there was an initiative like this in California, Attorney General Holder spoke up a month before the election, and he said to Californians, you better not do this because the feds, we're going to crack down. It's all illegal under federal law. This year, we didn't hear a word from Obama or Holder. That's significant. I think they looked at Colorado, a swing state. They saw that young voters are overwhelmingly in favor, and there was going to be a bulge in the youth vote this year, that independents lean our way as well. And they stayed quiet, notwithstanding the fact that the former heads of the DEA and the former drug czars all appealed to them to do so. And remember also that while the feds have the supremacy clause of the Constitution on their side that makes it hard for the states of Washington and Colorado to do something in opposition to federal law, we have the fiscal arguments, the political arguments, the public health arguments, and the moral arguments all on our side. If the feds block the states of Washington and Colorado from regulating this stuff, it essentially puts in the hands of the criminals. The public in those states said, we want the state government to tax and regulate this stuff. The feds are going to block that. So can the feds find a way to allow the state governments to do this so that this industry can be brought from the underground into the above ground in a responsible way?
Let me ask a question on the broad look at it again. We have two states now that have legalized it, Washington, Colorado. And there's a number of states that leading up to this have legalized it for medicinal reasons or medical reasons. How many states are there? And
well,
what's
Michael,
that
I'll tell
about?
You, you know, I mean, I was deeply involved in that beginning with California in 1996. There are now 18 states that have legalized marijuana for medical purposes.
Plus the two would make 20 states.
Well, no, Washington and Colorado had already legalized it for medical years ago. So you have 18 states in which it's now legal for medical purposes. And even in Washington and Colorado, if the federal government comes down and cracks down on the legal regulations regulatory system for non-medical users, the medical systems are protected. I mean, those things are now above ground. Colorado, right, not only did it vote to legalize medical marijuana in 2000, then the state legislature adopted very broad regulations for medical marijuana. There are now hundreds of dispensaries in Colorado. There is a medical marijuana enforcement division in Colorado. There are taxes being collected. The quality importance is being regulated. The growers are being overseen by local authorities. So Colorado actually already has a model for the legal regulation of marijuana with respect to the medicinal use.
Now, interesting, on medicinal use, doesn't make it more legal under the Supremacy Clause than any use of marijuana,
well,
does it? I mean, why?
There are a few variables there. One is that virtually all the states that have legalized for medical purposes, they typically have a residency requirement so that you can only sell or you can only get it if you're a legal resident of the state. With respect to the new initiatives, they don't have that, right?
Right, but so I'm saying vis-a-vis the Supremacy Clause, if it's federal government said it's illegal.
Exactly, Michael. I mean, that's our hope
here. It shouldn't make any difference whether it's medical or non-medical. Because they can go after the medical states, but they haven't really.
Exactly. Well, they have and they haven't. So when Obama was running for president the first time back in 08, and then right after he became president in 09, he basically said that going after medical marijuana in the states that have made it legal under state law should be a low priority for the Justice Department. And what that did, when that statement came out in 2009, that opened up essentially the floodgates to a lot of other things happening, states adopting regulations, dispensaries moving around. Then some of it got out of control. And the federal law piece, but both some of the growers got out of control, taking advantage, and some of the U.S. attorneys got out of control, saying it's all illegal under federal law, we're going to shut it down. But right now, the fact of the matter is you have hundreds, if not thousands, of dispensaries in many states. Some are very open-ended, like California. Others, like New Mexico or in New England, are very tightly controlled. Colorado has a for-profit system that is very expansive but very tightly regulated. So the fact of the matter is the feds do have a precedent for allowing state governments to regulate this stuff, and we're hoping that they'll follow this precedent with respect to what happened in Washington and Colorado.
The irony is that people on the other side who want to keep it illegal are, in many instances, criminals. Even the criminal cartels, say in Mexico, which supplies most of the marijuana for the United States. What's happening with those guys? And in particular, what kind of situation pertains here in the United States with the money laundering? We saw yesterday on the front page of the New York Times, HSBC Bank was fined $1.9 billion because they're laundering money for terrorist organizations and for drug lords in Mexico. Yeah. What's your take on that? What do you think about these criminal organizations?
You got three very good questions right in there. The first one I'd say with respect to HSBC and money laundering, I mean, it is a shame that those guys did not get criminally prosecuted as far as I can tell. But I have to say, even if the federal government was being really vigorous and going after these major multinational banks with criminal charges and cracking down on money laundering, it would make no difference to the overall flow of illegal drugs into this country around the world. I mean, there's a zillion ways, an infinite number of ways to launder money. It might raise the cost of the illegal business
a
bit.
The cost of doing business.
That's right, exactly. With respect to, who's going to benefit? Aren't it the criminals? Well, the fact of the matter is, if the feds prevent the state governments in Washington, Colorado from, responsibly regulating this stuff, you're essentially going to have a de facto alliance between the federal government on the one side and the most irresponsible elements of the marijuana community on the other, and a de facto alliance between law enforcement and political authorities in these states and the more responsible elements of the marijuana community. So it's crazy to think of the feds kind of basically subsidizing the criminals in this country and outside this country rather than supporting a regulatory approach. All that means is that the gangsters in Mexico, other illegal producers in the U.S., Canada, whatever, will continue to supply the market. That's the point.
Okay, that's
now,
really good.
What's interesting is the worst possible thing that could happen to the gangsters in Mexico and elsewhere is to legalize drugs, right? Because they would lose out, just like Al Capone and the other, organized crime lost out after alcohol prohibition. They tried to stay in, but ultimately the competitive advantage of criminal organizations is in the employment of violence and intimidation and corruption. It's not in marketing. It's not in dealing with government regulatory agencies, right? So inevitably what happens is when marijuana or any other drug becomes legalized, eventually it's going to be taken over by the legal entrepreneurs. My preference, by the way, would be that it would be more like a microbrewery market or a wine market and not be turned into the Budweiser or Marlboro of marijuana, which is a risk, living here in America. But the key is the gangsters would be the ones who would be really hurt. Now, the other interesting piece of this is what Latin American leaders are saying. And I think they're licking their chops right now because they're saying, here we're still got, you know, we have to fight this war. People are dying. And now Americans are saying that it's okay to buy it and sell this stuff. And the feds, they're pushing the feds to say, you're such hypocrites. What are you going to do about this? But the smarter leaders down there, and especially in Colombia and Mexico, Guatemala, Uruguay, elsewhere, they know that what Washington and Colorado did is the beginning of the ending of the global drug prohibition system, which has wreaked havoc in that region for decades. Now, I also think that some of those Latin American leaders are a bit envious, because when I ask some of them, why don't you move in the direction that of marijuana legalization? And they'll say, you know, our biggest problem is not Obama or the White House. Our biggest problem is that we don't have domestic support. In Mexico, only 30% of the public wants to legalize marijuana. In Colombia, in Uruguay, it's only 40%. So you actually have leaders out ahead of their public. And I think that those leaders are a little bit envious that the American public opinion is so dynamic that we can go in the last 8 years from one-third of the country saying they're in favor of this to over half the country now saying they're in favor of this.
You think there are more pot smokers in North America than in South America?
Probably. Probably more consumers here. But there's also the culture is more fluid in a way, too. It's interesting. You look what's happening on gay marriage, right? If you line up the Gallup polls for on gay marriage and on marijuana legalization, they line up almost exactly over the last 8 years. Both had one-third of the country more or less in favor and a little less than two-thirds opposed as of 8 years ago. Both are more or less split 50-50 right now. The difference, of course, is that, you know, on marijuana legalization, almost no politicians will come out publicly as yet. We don't have one member of the U.S. Senate who will do that. Whereas on gay marriage, you now have the White House, you have governors, senators, and others. So there's that sort of difference.
Let me ask you a side question, then we'll go back to the bigger picture for our last couple of questions. But you mentioned Budweiser and Marlboro and big entrepreneurs taking it over. I'm interested in the states that there are either medical marijuana or now that there'll be legalization, if there's different growers, different types of qualities, different levels of marijuana, or is it all like a generic
No, I mean, there are now hundreds, if not thousands, of types of varieties. And one of the things that's happening, there's a lot that's very interesting in this field. The first one, of course, is that there's more and more professionalism in it. There is now a company in the United Kingdom, GW Pharmaceutical, that Bayer Pharmaceutical just invested in, that is actually growing marijuana with government permission and trying to produce whole plant marijuana for medicinal purposes. In the medical world, there are people who have nothing to do with the marijuana area who are saying that the growing research into the endocannabinoids, basically what the part of our human body that is responsive to what's in marijuana, may be the single most fascinating area of research about brain and also therapeutic purposes that anything is happening, that is one of those fascinating parts of the human body. And this is not coming from advocates. This is coming from hard scientists. People are realizing that among the other ingredients in marijuana, we all know about THC, which makes you high. But there's another ingredient called CBD, which is the anti-anxiety, anti-inflammatory property of marijuana. And now the most expensive marijuana plants in the world are plants that are low in THC, so not very good at making you high, and high in CBD, which is the anti-anxiety. For some people who smoke marijuana 24/7 and it appears to be somewhat destructive but also self-medicative, it may be that the CBD part is the part that they're really looking for and yearning for. So there's remarkable research happening on.
I know people like that. That makes a lot of sense.
Exactly. It's happening both in the underground and semi-above ground level, and it's happening in the pharmaceutical world. In fact, one way to think about what's really going on in the big picture right now is that there's essentially a race between, on one side, the federal government and the pharmaceutical companies looking to pharmaceuticalize this as fast as possible so that they can seize all the profits. And on the other side, between people in the marijuana business world and people like me in the marijuana policy reform, who do this as a matter of principle, who are trying to get marijuana legalized so that this can be more or less regulated like alcohol and tobacco. And the pharmaceutical companies will still have a role to play because there will still be a role for isolating the ingredients of marijuana and providing them as medicines, but they should not be dominating the recreational side of this thing.
Ethan Nadelman from the Drug Policy Alliance, it's great to talk to you. Let me ask you, what is your organization doing now, and what would you have supporters like us do to help you?
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, people should realize that the one link between everything that's going on is the Drug Policy Alliance. We were the only major national organization that was involved in a deep way, both in Washington State and in Colorado. In Washington State, we were one of the largest funders. In Colorado, we were deeply involved in the drafting, the grassroots organizing, and we're the only one involved in what's going on there and what's going on in Latin America, where earlier this year, the president of Uruguay, Mujica, proposed that Uruguay legally regulate marijuana, and where you have the president of Colombia is saying open the debate, and the president of Guatemala is saying open the debate. So we're there, we're that link, and we're the link to what's happening here in New York City about taking on NYPD around these marijuana arrests, and we're the ones working on medical marijuana. So New Jersey just started; they just opened their first legal dispensary last week. We led that effort soup to nuts and fought for that. And meanwhile, there's going to be a major campaign in New York this coming year, 2013, to legalize medical marijuana. So we are the link. What I can say, what people can do is go to drugpolicy.org and sign up, become a member, support the organization. The Drug Policy Alliance, we are increasingly respected in the U.S. and around the world, but we're not yet feared. We need to be feared if we're really going to take this to a new level.
I imagine you're getting to the point of being feared. I mean, 18 states legalized medical, and two of those altogether. This is a pretty big push.
We're getting there, and our opponents are freaked out. But let's not forget, America still leads the world in incarceration rates, right? Yeah. We're still less than 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's incarcerated population. We're not, remember, only one-third of our work or 40% focused on marijuana. We're about reducing incarceration. We're about fighting the racism and the drug war. We're about reducing overdose fatalities in the spirit of AIDS and hepatitis. It's all about reducing the harms of drugs and the harms of a failed prohibitionist policy.
Well, Ethan, we've been interviewing you on and off for years. This has got to be, it's the biggest smile I've ever seen you have.
The best year I've ever had.
Ethan, congratulations.
I want to say, we knew you when you were just the nose of a camel. And now we know you and your nose is under the tent.
Incredible work. Incredible.
Yeah. I mean, and eventually we take over the tent, but years to go and a lot of work to do.
Ethan, thank you so much for being on Law & Disorder. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Protests and violence continue in Egypt and in Syria. In Egypt, Islamist President Mohamed Morsi pushes towards ratifying a draft constitution. Egyptians who opposed the controversial new constitution argue it weakens human rights and doesn't guarantee women's rights, that was written by an Islamist-dominated assembly. The opposition National Salvation Front said it will not recognize the draft constitution. We talk about that and about the unfolding events in Syria with the ongoing civil war there with Glenn Ford, the founder of the Black Agenda Report. Glenn, welcome to Law & Disorder.
Glenn Ford, welcome to Law & Disorder.
Hey, thanks for the opportunity.
It's great to have you back, and I was thinking about you a lot lately as I read the, quote, news about Egypt, the way it's portrayed here in our media, as well as Syria and the way that's portrayed, and I said to Smith, I said, well, we need Glenn Ford to tell us what's going on. So anyway, let's start wherever you'd like, but we can start today. The U.S. Recognized, quote, the opposition in Syria as legitimate or something like that. Give us some sense of, from your perspective, what's really going on in Syria, Egypt, et cetera.
Well, if you want to start off with Egypt, you know, especially American leftists identify with people who speak their language, then want to make a common cause and sometimes skewed judgments about what's happening with the folks who speak their language. And I'm talking about secular left folks in Egypt and their relative strength. What Americans need to know is that in the Muslim world, in the Arab world, the left has been decimated not once, not twice, but over and over and over again in the last 40, 50, 60 years. And that's occurred in Egypt, in Syria, in Iraq, in Iran, which is not Arab, of course, but all over the region. The left has, through all of these massacres, actual or political or both, been marginalized. And it's to be expected that in Egypt, the part of secular Egypt that is left would represent maybe 15, at the most 20% of the people. And I'm being kind of liberal with that. The language of politics in that part of the world is spoken in an Islamic dialect. And it's difficult for left folks here to understand it. It's a strange talk to us, and we are not usually able to identify the cast of characters, except these are secular people, or these seem to be folks who were allied with those who collaborated with the United States. And there over there is that mass of Islamists, and that's kind of hopeless, and I don't know how to relate to that. But we have to face the fact that in Egypt, the secularists, and especially progressives among the secularists, do not stand a chance in hell of winning majorities in elections, and can only expect to put some vocal minorities in parliament. They can't stop the Egyptian Islamists, whether from the Muslim Brotherhood or the Salafist parties, which garnered 25% of the vote. They can't stop them from passing a constitution. And the choice then becomes, are you going to try to sabotage or boycott or somehow disrupt the constitutional process, which plays into the hands of the military and the Mubarak supporters who are everywhere and who are also demonstrating side by side with left secularists? Or are you going to find a way to deal with those different tendencies that call themselves Islamists?
As I read, I of course saw that, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamists won 51% of the votes in the election. They then had a parliament, and then they had a constituent assembly or something to write the constitution. Then I read the other day in the paper that the constitution will not be defeated at the polls. It will be approved, and therefore the only thing left to the opposition was to try and boycott it, to try and show they had some strength. So yet we have the West here pushing this whole thing as we have a dictator in power, Morsi, Islamists in power. They're imposing their will on the people. And yet you're saying the people aren't really who we think the people are, I guess.
And we have to understand that this judiciary that many of the secularists, including much of the progressive secularists, are making common cause with, the judiciary is made up of holdovers from the Mubarak regime and or supporters of the military. They're not necessarily one and the same, but they're pretty close. And this judiciary has thwarted the formation of anything that could be called a people's government, that is a democratic government that it can actually do what it's elected to do, up and down the line. So we now have the left, sometimes on the barricades, with a very reactionary judiciary and holdovers of the Mubarak regime. And I don't know what kind of impression that is making on the Egyptian people.
Well, if you were over there, not here, who would you align yourself with? What would you be for?
Well, there was a candidate named Sahabi. It looked like he finished a strong third or fourth, but he didn't make it into the runoff. He'd been involved in much of the groundwork that actually led up to what we call the Arab Spring, that is years and years of union organizing, and where there weren't unions, just organizing workers who were unaffiliated, lots of mass activity and demonstrations, all that preceding the involvement of young people from classes that could afford internet and from students. Many of these were latecomers to a movement that among grassroots working people that Sabahi, I believe that's how you pronounce his name, had already been involved in. But again, he wasn't going to get more than 20% of the vote, no matter how the lineup was advantageously configured. And that's what the left is going to have to deal with and look in the long run to see how they can make alliances with folks who call themselves Islamist.
We're speaking with Glenn Ford, a founder of Black Agenda Report. And Glenn, I want to go back to how you opened this and then talk about what the role of the United States is. But you opened it by saying something about how a lot of the left here in the U.S., I think, I don't want to misquote you, doesn't really get it in Egypt. And if I were to reflect on that, when I read a lot of the progressive press or liberal press, it's all, you know, it's all supporting these 15% secularists. It's this dictator of Morsi. And how would you give them a more nuanced view? What I really don't understand is why they use this sort of, quote, human rights framework and come out in a certain way against the Muslim Brotherhood. And it's just like a herd going toward people who are opposed to the government that are in Tahrir Square.
Well, you know, in addition to the lack of basic understanding of the political economies and the lay of the land politically in these countries, leftists here get confused by the corporate media, which inflates business secularists in contests all over the world and mix and matches folks to make it appear that folks who reflect the Washington consensus are actually viable in terms of mass appeal. You know, this may seem like an aside, but they do this with Russia as well. How many people, even in your circles, and I'm sure there are real smart people in your circles, how many people, Americans, realize that the opposition party, the consistently and always party number two in Russia, is the old Communist Party? When we see coverage of dissent in Russia, we see all these folks who look very much like American yuppies. But that's not who the opposition to Putin's party is. It's the Communist Party, which often gathers 20 and sometimes, if the lay of the land is right, 30% of the vote in some local elections. Yeah. So these distortions by the corporate media magnify our basic ignorance about what's going on in various countries, and we're often left just with our prejudices and very wishful imaginations.
The same reactionary forces in the Middle East, like the government of Saudi Arabia or Qatar, who are interfering in Egypt, are also doing the same thing in Syria. And then you have the United States trying to interfere. Then you have Russia and Iran trying to interfere. Can you tell me what you think the relationship of forces is in Syria and what's going on?
Well, as you said, everybody's at work in Syria. Qatar and Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and freelance millionaires from all over the region are sponsoring their own brigades, their own little fighting forces. You know, there are literally hundreds and hundreds of insurgents, whatever you would like to call them, whether sponsored or homegrown, with their small military outfits, all calling themselves brigades and divisions. They all have sponsors. What's interesting in the latest news is that the United States has designated one of the outfits fighting in Syria. I believe it's fighting in the north, and it's, according to the coverage, made lots of headway against the government. It's designated one of those outfits as terrorist, as Al-Qaeda affiliated, and I have no doubt that they are. But 75 other fighting organizations, that's why I told you there are literally hundreds of them, so when I say 75, that doesn't mean
right.
That doesn't mean it's necessarily 10,000 men. But anyway, 75 other fighting organizations have denounced the United States for designating that group as Al-Qaeda, and they're basically saying they're not going to listen to the United States or any of the foreigners, and they'll carry out their jihad the way they want to. That's an omen for what's to come, whether the Assad regime falls or not. But, you know, we really ought to talk about why the United States is in bed with so many Salafists and jihadists to the point that it has to make that kind of move to try to disassociate it itself at this late date. Why it seems so dependent now on the Saudis and the other royal thieves from Qatar.
Well, that's the bigger picture we'd love to hear you talk about, because obviously we've watched Libya go down, we've watched Arab Spring. So give us some overall perspective would be great.
Now, I think that the United States ruling circles, to use that term, really panicked back in January and February of this new phenomenon, the Arab Spring. And you could really tell by watching CNN. You know, those guys don't say anything unless they get their cues from the State Department or the White House or the Pentagon. They really have nothing to say unless they've been scripted properly. And for a week, as Mubarak was teetering and then gone, the CNN reporters were at a loss. When CNN is at a loss, it means that the people at the State Department are not giving them their cues, and it means they are at a loss. The hysteria, the confusion, the desperation was really palpable. You could read it in between the lines of the New York Times and all the other corporate media. They weren't getting their cues either. What happened was the United States and Europe, seeing this new phenomenon, wondering when things might fall apart, decided, well, they made the only decision that they have nowadays when U.S. and European soft power ain't what it used to be because their economic power isn't what it used to be. They went back to basics with their weapons, and they decided that they would have to make a huge show of force in the region. And the convenient target was, of course, Gaddafi. Gaddafi had already been demonized for decades and decades. I don't believe that they had planned on regime change in Libya at that time, although, of course, the United States always has contingencies to take out everybody. But that they decided that this would be a good place for them to make a shock and awe, a massive show of force. And that's why they attacked Libya. The problem was, of course, that they had nobody on the ground, everybody speaking Islamic language, as we discussed earlier. But the Saudis and the royals from Qatar and the Emirates did. That's part of their world. And so began this renewed relationship between the United States and the Saudis and these jihadis that had begun after the Soviets' involvement in Afghanistan after 1979. That's when the United States and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan created out of whole cloth the International Jihadi Network. Before the CIA and the Saudis and the Pakistanis got together to create a force to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan, no such thing existed as an international jihadi network. There were Salafists, of course, all over the Muslim world, but they didn't have an international network. That was put together with billions and billions of dollars from the CIA and the Saudis, and with Pakistan as the base area. And remember when the CIA bragged that that was their most successful operation ever, or at least since the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran in 1953.
We're talking with Glenn Ford, founder of Black Agenda Report, and he's now talking about the setup of the international jihadists, really, to try and push the Soviets out of Afghanistan.
Right. So this new relationship with jihadists is not totally original. It's a renewal of a relationship that was started in earnest back in the early 80s. And we know what the blowback from that was. That's where we got Osama bin Laden. Now the United States, and I think it's a sign of the desperation of U.S. imperialism, now the United States, with that whiff of an Arab Spring, decided that it would renew that kind of alliance. And they became even more dependent because they needed folks on the ground with those Wahhabists, as reactionary as you can get in Saudi Arabia, and with the royal regime in Qatar, to mobilize jihadis, not just Libyans, although the Al-Qaeda-associated elements had been well established in Libya for some time, but also from all over the Muslim world.
Are you including Syria in that also, Glenn?
Actually, the Syrian situation really, really heated up after the fall of Gaddafi's regime. And 600 to 900 of the Libyan jihadis were then sent directly to Syria, along with thousands of others from elsewhere. So that was like phase two, and it was a pretty smooth transition, just using the fighters that they already had, who were already fired up and ready to kill, sending them to Syria.
So what forces is the United States aligned with in Syria? And then the second part of that question is, what is the left doing in Syria, and what strength do they have?
A basic weakness of the United States here. The U.S. Being a Western country, an insular country, a country that doesn't respect other people's, their politics or their customs or their religions. You know, it's really a racist country. Does not have the direct contacts on the ground to mount the Syrian kind of operation. It didn't have it to mount the operation in Libya. That's why they needed the Saudis and the Qataris. And certainly with an even larger operation like in Syria, the U.S. was just outclassed in terms of getting actual bodies there. So they now are very dependent on the Saudis and those guys from the Emirates, and as I said before, freelance millionaires and billionaires in the Arab and Muslim world who are sponsoring their own outfits. It's really not in totally in U.S. hands.
We're interested in what your perception is of the strength of the left in Syria.
You know, in terms of the left as we would recognize it, it's quite weak. It became institutionalized, locked up, if not ground down, by the Syrian Baathist regime. The Syrian Baath regime was certainly not as repressive or brutal as the Iraqi Baath regime that was Saddam Hussein. And they incorporated many other leftists into their apparatus, but it was still a Baathist outfit. I don't think the left has, outside of the workings of the regime and its network, has any real independent ability to affect the situation.
Glenn, how do you see the future? If you can predict anything happening in Syria, in Egypt, in the Middle East, the U.S.?
This is going to be the mother of all blowbacks. However, I think it will accelerate the decline of imperialism. Although these Salafists and jihadis are, by our measurements, quite backward and reactionary, they are not progressive. One of the things about political Islam is that it behaves very much like a nationalism. And nationalisms of any kind.
Glenn Ford, again, it's just remarkable to listen to you. I mean, you're one of the most astute observers of the political scene that I know, and we really want to thank you for being with us. And tell us, how do people go to your Black Agenda report?
Oh, even I can do it, so it must be real simple. Just go to www.blackagendareport.com, and we have a new issue out every Wednesday, which will also be true today if I can get back and finish this article. Everybody else has finished but me.
Well, I recommend it highly. It's really where you're going to hear what you don't hear or see on even the liberal media in this country. Thank you, Glenn Ford.
Thank you, Glenn.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.